Our final panelist will be Jay. Why don't you come up and bring it home, Jay?
Jay Elias, alcoholic. Big thanks to Corey and Brandon, especially, for the invite to come out here and speak on this panel. I found that speaking when asked is one of the many, many equally important parts that make up the treatment of this thing I got, right? And I got a thing, for sure. thanks for all the service you guys have put in, Cassie, and everything, putting this thing on. It's super encouraging to walk around. I got a lot of young friends that are in the YPAW-associated stuff, you know, ASCII-PAW and stuff like that. And it's so cool, it's so encouraging to see so many young people making a decision to take responsibility for their recovery, you know? And I'm sure that you guys are probably certain that that was a good idea to try to get sober, but it was a really good idea because, you know, you never know with your best intentions, and we all think the same thing. I grew up in Southern California. I had a silver spoon in my mouth. My dad graduated Berkeley. He was a senior vice president, a Coldwell banker. I was supposed to do big things. I played a lot of baseball. I was supposed to go to like Stanford or USC and all that stuff. And instead, I found myself catching my first felony case at the age of 24. And I'll get to that in a second. And I didn't have a chance. To get sober and save the rest of my life, you know, and I get kind of emotional when I see so many youngsters literally like on the verge of saving their life, man. It's pretty cool. So on May 3rd, 2010, I did something that up until that point was never on the table as an option, never was anything that I considered doing. It was, you know, it was just not a thing. And I reached out and I asked another man for help that was involved in a 12-step fellowship. And his name was Dennis Talbot. I feel comfortable telling you his full name because I had to say goodbye to him in 2015. And I'm super grateful. Anytime anybody asks me to speak, I get an opportunity to do it a lot, and I'm grateful for it. And the first thing I always ask is, how long is it, you know? They're like 15 minutes, 30 minutes and something. I'm like, whew. Because anything 40 and above, I got to talk about Dennis, you know? And I may look tough and everything with my tattoos, but I can't do it. It's still pretty tough, man. Dennis was my guy. So I'll give you my history real quick, man. I started stealing wine coolers out of my parents' fridge when I was 14, and I ended up getting strung out on heroin in state penitentiary. Whatever you guys can fit in between there, use your imagination, get creative. It just, if you need details, hit me up after the meeting. I'll fill you in. there was no limit to what I would do for alcohol and other things. Nobody was off limits, there was no boundaries. I'd like to think that I wouldn't defraud my brother or my family any quicker than I would a normal stranger. I guess maybe if I did, there was a little pause, but it wasn't significant. You know, nobody was immune from what I did. Yeah, my story was pretty similar, man. My drinking and substance abuse progressed normally. I had my not yet list, my it's not like I'm yet list, you know, and I slowly spent the years checking stuff off that. You know, it's not like I'm drinking every day, it's not like I'm missing school, it's not like I'm missing work, it's not like I'm doing drugs, it's not like I'm on and on and on and on and on. Until the last one, you know, it's not like I'm getting in trouble for this stuff. And at the age of 24, I had been introduced to something that proved to be a little too much for me. And at the age of 24, I found myself with 35 felony fraud charges. And the state of Arizona was pretty upset. And I remember my parents had decided, a very weird time. You know, I guess there's a certain point in all of our lives where the parents decide this is the cutoff point where you're going to grow up. We're done. Well, that was the time they did it. And it was a really weird time for them to do that because I called my mom from county jail and I'm like, dude, I'm in a jam. And she's like, well, what's new? And I said, yeah, but this one is serious. She goes, well, what's up? And I said, they want to give me 5 years in prison. And she was like, damn. All right, well, call us and let us know what happens. That's not our relationship, you know what I mean? You're supposed to come down and bail me out, you know? And if you are ever going to cut me off and decide this is time for Jay to be an adult, do it when my car breaks down or something and I want it fixed. Do it when I can't pay my rent or my something. Not when I'm about to go to the state penitentiary. That's a really weird time to bail and say, you got to grow up on your own now. Like, I need you guys. But that was it. So in county jail, I turned 25 years old, and they drove me out to Douglas, Arizona. They dropped me off at a unit called Mojave Unit, start a five-year sentence. That was in 1995. Yeah, I'm old. It's pretty funny, huh, Cassie? Yeah. The yard had a nickname called Little Vietnam, which I didn't understand then. I did later. And I remember one of the officers walked me with my duffel bag up to the Sally Port. I remember that big gate opening up, and they have the old school gun tower and stuff. And he said, you're in 4 Alpha 7, good luck. I was like, that was weird. You know, why would you wish me luck? You know what I mean? It was a pretty gnarly place. But back up a little bit. And so through my progression, I've been in the repeat offender program since the year 2000. I've been to prison 4 times. I spent a total of 16 years there. And so what I did when I got there to Mojave Unit, I began a long process. You see, I was always convinced until this program that my problem and my solution lied outside of me, right? And so I spent my first whole five-year sentence formulating a game plan. Okay, so I'm not going to hang out with snitches anymore. Probably need to move out of Arizona because their laws are too strict. I can't mess with strung-out dancers. So I'm like... You know, and I'm going through this checklist, and I think I formulate a pretty good plan. And then I get out, and I'm drinking in 3 months, and I'm violated, and I got to go back and finish my sentence. So I go back for the second time, and this time I get out the checklist, and I'm like, what did I do wrong? Because I'm a really put-together dude, right? I mean, even today, I mean, I'm the dude that's like the fourth time in prison, and I'm like 14 years into my, and I'm on the blue phone calling my mom, Colette, giving her advice on what she needs to do with her life. This is just my part of my disease, man, you know? And so I spend my next sentence trying to figure out exactly where I went wrong. I formulate a new game plan, get out. 2 months later, I'm drinking, back to doing my thing, and then I get a 6-year sentence, you know? And so again, I spend that 6 years trying to formulate a really good game plan this time, trying to whittle it down to just fine-tune this thing because I'm not gonna do this stuff. There's no way that I can't quit drinking, and there's no way that I can't quit using, and I can't, dude, I wouldn't go to prison. I was supposed to be somebody. Dude, my dad went to Berkeley. I grew up in Southern California. I'm smart, you know? Who's making me do this, you know? And got out after that, you know what I mean? And stayed out a little bit longer this time, but went back again. But during that third sentence, man, I had started to get really accustomed to the jail and prison environment and stuff and kind of came up the ranks, whatever that's called. And so in county jail fighting that case, you know, we used to all have to coordinate, you know, our really important business with the other guys in the other towers. So we would always pick like church or 12-step meetings or something like that. And we'd turn out like we were interested in it, but we'd all go huddle up in the corner and talk about really important stuff like cigarette traffic and like who needed to get beat up for like telling on, you know, all the important stuff. And we think we're pretty important dudes, even though we're all wearing elastic pants, using golf pencils and drinking out of kindergarten size and milk cartons. But besides that, we all think we're pretty thuggish, you know what I mean? So we had decided to, there was a 12-step meeting ran by a dude named Dennis T. And we were always really respectful, you know? And we would go up there and conduct our important business, whatever that was. And one time he hit me up as I was leaving the meeting. He was a little dude, like looked like Dennis Leary off of Easy Rider. You know, had a little whistle with his S's and stuff, man. Big old Chester glasses and all that stuff. He was cool. He said, say, brother, he goes, I see you coming in here every week, man. And you ever listen to any of these tapes that I play? Because he would play speaker tapes, you know. I said, yeah, I mean, a little bit, you know. And he said, okay. And he said, well, I just want to let you know that you don't have to live like this anymore, man. There's a different way to do things. And if you want to talk, let me know. All right, dude. You know what I mean? Thanks, dude. So anyways, it was kind of weird. I went on to prison, got another 6 years, whatever, and, you know, he had followed me, and we used to write, and I'd shoot him little postcards and stuff. I knew where his home group was, and he'd never pushed the program on me. He'd always just write me unsolicited, see how I was doing, and he'd always sign my letters at the end. You don't have to live like this anymore. There's a different way to do things. And during my fourth prison sentence, I specifically remember being super serious about not messing around this time. Like, I specifically went into that prison sentence with a game plan. Not only am I not gonna mess around with anything, any hooch or anything like that, but I'm not messing around any of the politics. I'm not gonna run any yards. I'm not gonna get involved. I mean, I'm gonna go to Rio Salado. I'm gonna take some college classes. I had a game plan. But on May 2nd, 2010, some of the right, wrong people in there that were friends of mine that are affiliated with a not so healthy group of individuals in there asked me to come over and help him conduct some business and stuff. And I was without defense to say no. And I was under the influence again. And I couldn't believe it, man. I could not believe it. That is, I was right in the middle of my fourth prison sentence. And I was really super serious, man, about not messing around. But when he offered this thing to me, I was without defense. It was like I had one of those strange mental blank spots that they talk about. And I was unable to bring into consciousness with sufficient force. I didn't even need to bring into consciousness with sufficient force the memory of a week or a month ago. I'm in the mother effing penitentiary right now. Like, I should really be able to, like, see the consequences of that, and I'm still wearing orange elastic pants. But I cannot differentiate that. So I went back to my cell, and I realized for the first time in my life, I was able to differentiate the true from the false. And the true was that the best I could come up with concerning this thing, I didn't know it was a disease then, but this thing that I had, everything I had thrown at it, my gift of gab, my cool tattoos, my Southern California attitude, my high intelligence, my abilities to overcome, and my capabilities to surmount obstacles, the best I could come up with was drugs, alcohol, and the penitentiary. Over and over and over again. And there was nothing to suggest it was going to be any different. So I wrote Dennis on May 3rd, 2010. I told him I needed some help. And thank God for H&I. Thank God for people like Dennis. Dennis wrote me for the next 4 years of my prison sentence. And I worked my steps with him. I got a job in substance abuse, and I got meetings registered, and I ran meetings at 6:30 in the morning, every morning, Monday through Friday, for 4 years. And I told all my right, wrong friends on the prison yard, I told them, hey man, I'm gonna make a serious attempt at saving my life. And fortunately, some of my friends, they were cool guys. They said, go ahead, man. And I worked my steps, and I got out in December of 2014. And you know, last year, my girlfriend and I, we went to Thailand, and yeah, they gave me a passport. And you know, I've closed like this since we went, you know, and I've got to share a lot since then. So we're walking through Guangzhou, China, on our way to Thailand, and we go through this big, they're pretty gnarly over there with airport security. Very stern face, Asian ladies and stuff with suits, and you have to walk up to this kiosk, and they have a digital thing with fingerprints, and I'm like, I got this, you know, and you got to do your, it tells you what to do, and you get fingerprinted, and then you got to get in front of the camera, and they take facial recognition, and then they scan your passport. And after all this whole shebang, this high-tech screening, they print you out a ticket, and they hand you the ticket, and on that ticket it said, okay. And I looked at it, and I said, you know what, that was pretty significant, because for the first time in my entire life, dude, things were okay. For the first time in my entire life, I was okay. Now, you know, I've been fingerprinted quite a few times in my life, and it's never fucking been okay. You know what I mean? It's never been okay. Now, you may think that on May 3rd, 2010, I had just had enough and decided just to get my life together. That I had just decided to blossom into this amazing mofo that I always thought I could become. But that happens to be the same day that I started working in the 12-step program. And I think it had something to do with that, and I'm super grateful. Thanks.
Let's go ahead and thank each of our panelists one more time. So we still have 5 or 6 minutes. I want to open up the floor to each of our panelists for a question and answer session. So if you'll raise your hand, speak your question, I'll repeat it into the microphone, and we'll let them answer on their own terms. Do we have any questions out there?
I don't think I'm ready for questions. Just wanted to thank you guys. Didn't know it was going to be open for questions, but that was awesome. And I'm still kind of thinking, I'm kind of processing it right now.
That's fine, man. We can come back to you. In the second row.
Some individuals in prison, you know what I mean? And so I think if you went in there and you went to, you know, the counselors and stuff and expressed a sincere desire, you know, you might not have enough time and all that to get it registered and official and all that, but anytime you can get together or get a room open and you've got yourself and another person and you've got Alcoholics Anonymous, you have a meeting, you know what I mean? And that's really all it takes, you know? And I think that sometimes what I found was that as soon as they saw somebody like me up there doing it, all of a sudden there was a lot of guys that wanted to get better, but they were too limited by what other people would think. And once they saw some of the cool guys going and getting a little blue book, you know, and talking about getting better and talking about spiritual stuff, they saw that it was okay. And like literally, I mean, like we had like 40, 45 guys coming every morning, and guys were like, "What's going on in there?" I'm like, "Don't worry about it. I'm trying to get well. Get some guys right now." You know, so.
Any other questions from the floor? Yes, gentleman in the back.
Daniel, alcoholic.
Hey, Dan.
So, you mentioned that you have been in prison, you know, multiple times before, actually, when you started to put in the work. Your surroundings were the same just the day before you reached out for help. You were in the same cell. But what shifted inside from when you were in that prison sentence prior to once you reached out and asked for help? How did you feel internally that, you know, there was a change?
Well, I mean, that was the trick of it, right? So I think that, you know, somebody would probably answer that question was like, you know, I hit my bottom. But for me, it was more, I mean, dude, I lived in the bottom. You know what I mean? Like, there was no, like, deeper to go. I mean, you can only go to so many prisons, dude. You know what I mean? Like, 6 is not lower than 7. I mean, it's still a prison sentence, but... You know, that was, I believe now along my spiritual path that I had become ready. It's funny because when I first got sober
and then transferred out here to the streets and started working with somebody. I said, hey man, you know, looking back, I think I've ruined a life, man. And I'm grateful to be sober, but I've just ruined a life. I've completely ruined a life to the ground, man. I'm 40 years old, 40-something years old, you know. And he said, nah, man. He said, you were just getting uniquely qualified to help a bunch of people. And I looked down and I said, what? And he goes, you had to go through exactly what you went through to get ready to be of service to other people. And he said, and I know you don't know what that's about yet, but you will. And so the only thing I can come up with was that the universe was ready for me to take what I had and move on, because I got hit with a thunderbolt of clarity that all the smoke and mirrors was gone. And even though I was under the influence heavily, I was able to see that this was what it was going to be like. And there was going to be no outgrowing a phase. There was going to be no, like, anything different, man, unless something got different. And in Bill's story, when I get to speak in longer environments and stuff, you know, Bill says something about that. He says, you know, it was a devastating blow to my pride. Here, who I had always thought so highly of my capabilities and my abilities, just not obstacles, was cornered at last. Now, Bill didn't get sober right after that, but I relate to that experience. I was cornered at last. And there was, because I didn't come to this program because I thought it was a good idea, because I heard a bunch of good stuff about it, and it definitely wasn't, I definitely didn't come here because I listened to speakers and wondered what they had, because they talked about honesty, God, making amends, and helping other people. I didn't want anything to do with that. That did not seem like a fix for my thing, so I didn't come here because I thought, hey, that AA thing sure seems like a good place to go. I just had nowhere else to go. And I was convinced that it was just going to be like this forever, man, and I was fortunate enough to have a dude that had that something, man, that just wouldn't leave me alone, man, for years. And he was just ready, waiting for me to get ready. And I haven't, dude, ever since that day, man, I have not touched nothing, dude. It's been over 9 years. And there has been a revolutionary change in my life, dude, and it's just bizarre what goes on in my life. So I don't know, other than the fact that I think the universe just thought that I was ready, man, to take my experience and get well, take it out there, you know, like he sponsored a lot of dudes to get out of prison and speak in places at like MTC and or MRC and RI and stuff, and it's been a cool thing, you know, for sure. So.
I think we have time for one more brief question if anybody has something on their mind.
Mike,
hey Mike.
To a higher power when I feel I need help. I thank him when I feel that I've gotten help. I've also gotten a lot out of helping other people, and that hasn't always come through sponsorship. Like, I do sponsor guys, but just helping people, being kind and generous and helping people helps. Self-improvement, I'm on this new self-improvement kick. Anything I can do to better myself, it is giving me this feeling that I'm becoming a better person. I almost get a high out of it. I'm bettering my mind, I'm bettering my health. I'm working on relationships, and as I'm improving, I feel like I'm improving as a human being. And that has, when I feel good about myself, I don't want to use as often, right? I don't think about numbing the pain as often when I feel better. And then I go to meetings. I stay close to people that are doing the same thing as me. We stick together, we help each other through it. I have a good support group and a good sponsor, and that's kept me sober so far. Right when I got out of prison, it was my second day I came to this convention, and then I just got super plugged in. I stayed really close to the fellowship. And that's kept me sober.
Cool. Let's give our panelists one final hand. And I just wanted to thank WIPA and specifically ASCIPA for putting on such a phenomenal weekend and organizing these fantastic speakers. And, you know, just remember that recovery is like sex. If you're not enjoying it, then you're not doing it right. So let's go ahead and circle up, and we'll close with the Serenity Prayer.